Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years providing solutions for sports field managers. Well, I've taken back control of the show from Teresa after she took it from me last week, claiming that I was busy.
You were busy.
But even though I have control, I still don't know what the hell's on the show. What's on the show today, Teresa?
Well, why don't we start talking about the relationship between coaches and groundskeepers? Is that a good place to go?
Well, that sounds like a winner. And in our Out of the Park segment, we'll be talking with Jack Warren, host of the Top Coach podcast, which deals with coaching baseball at the high school and college level. We'll talk to Jack about the coaches' challenges at those levels, especially when it comes to field conditions and their needs to improve conditions.
Yep, and then we're going to walk away from the coaches and we're going to talk about science. Yay! It's time to think about disease, guys. Let's see what we have to worry about this year.
Can we talk about the foot fungus I've got?
Ew.
Because I could use some answers for that.
Oh,
we'll have
away.
All of that and more coming up on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. And welcome, everybody, back to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. I'm Paul Zawoski, your host for the podcast, and I'm joined by, as usual, Teresa Beyer, my very talented co-host and producer of the show.
Hello, greetings and salutations.
How is the child rearing going?
So far, so good. Little one is asleep right now, so that's good.
That's good. So, today, we're going to be talking about coaching.
I don't know anything about coaching.
But you did work in the minors for a while.
Yes.
Did you ever have to deal with the coaches?
Yes. On occasion. Yeah. And actually,
Was it a positive experience or a negative experience?
It was mostly positive. Mostly positive. We had a couple of jerks come through who didn't want to talk at all. They just wanted to do their thing. But mostly positive, where they wanted to hear what we knew as far as recommendations and all of that, you know. You know, in the minor leagues, you just sometimes the field has a bad day. It's like, do you guys really have to hit today? But you do the best you can.
Well, and I always looked at coaches kind of as the buffer between the players and us.
Yeah, I tried not to talk to the players.
Yeah, because if you leave it to the players will come up to you and tell you how they want everything.
Yep.
And you got 25 different opinions out there. And,
yeah.
You know, where this typically really took place was with mounds and pitchers.
Yeah.
And, you know, pitchers can be very picky. And I mean, let's just face it. Some of these pitchers are head cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're really crazy. And, you know, you'd have pitchers come up to you and say, hey, can you make this mound flat? And the next guy comes up to, hey, I need this really steep. Or I need, you know. And I just made it a policy that we set the mound at the beginning of the year, and it stayed that way until playoffs. And playoffs, then I'd do all the funky stuff if I had to, whatever it took to get that bonus check. But during the season, I usually didn't change much unless it came through the coach, if the coach asked for it.
Yeah.
And what I would tell the players when they came up and asked me, and I'd say, well, talk to your pitching coach and have him talk to me about it, and we'll go from there. Because if you tried to have a conversation sometimes with the pitcher, you know, they weren't going to take anything but yes for an answer.
Yeah.
You know, without reasoning about, well, how does this affect the other pitchers, that kind of stuff and things like that.
Oh, they don't care about the other pitchers.
Well, that's right. They only care about how is their record doing.
Exactly.
So you know, from that standpoint, I kind of used coaches as a buffer in that situation. And the coaches, typically, because they weren't the ones on the field playing, they didn't have, you know, they didn't get as wound up about certain little things like that. You know, they were kind of the steady voice.
Yeah.
Not always, but most of the time. The other thing that you know, coaches are really good at sometimes is sometimes helping you teach you something about the field that you might not know from a playability standpoint and things like that.
Yeah.
And they can be just as good at teachers about telling you what makes an infield better sometimes if you're not really sure than the feedback you get from them.
Absolutely.
Or the feedback you get from players. You know, I always made it a policy to always be at the batting cage when the Orioles were hitting the whole time. That was the time that players could come up and voice their opinions if they had one about the field, good or bad. You know, and it wasn't that often that I got negative feedback or constructive feedback, but I wanted to make sure I was available to them. You know, and the coaching staff, especially in the early days of my career, the coaches, especially Cal Senior and Cal, you know, Cal is probably one of the most analytical guys I ever met in baseball. And I learned a lot about infields from both of those guys.
Cool.
And from that, then I took my soils education and applied that to that and developed
my
infields.
In the minors, I learned more from you major guys who had, you know, who were dealing with the highest end, who were dealing with the thoroughbreds of the players.
Yeah.
Because down in the minors, you never know if you've got a thoroughbred or if you've got a workhorse. And so you don't know if the input that they're giving you is input that's going to benefit the whole team or just based off of their one little experience.
Well, and to a certain degree, they're still pretty young.
Yep.
Even though, and Durham was what, double A at the time,
I think,
right? They were triple A? Okay. Mm-hmm. So now, you were getting guys who are close to the top at that point.
They're in a different situation where, you know, they've been up and back a couple of times usually. And so they're playing a different game than the guys in double A.
Yeah.
And in single A for that matter. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, to a certain extent, you've got guys there who haven't really seen it all
right yet.
Although I sometimes beg to differ because back in those days, there were a lot of bad minor league fields. But just because, you know, this was, you were in there at the time when the 90s was a huge explosion of building of minor league ballparks. Yep. Before then, I mean, some of that stuff was just ugly.
Oh, leftovers from the 60s.
Old and dilapidated way before that.
Of
that stuff was, you know, just incredible. But now, you know, it's rare to see a minor league park that's in that kind of condition anymore. They're usually very pristine.
Also
like
an explosion of groundskeepers that had been to school.
Right, exactly. That was a combination of both of those things. And one needed the other. The new stadiums needed the educated groundskeepers to take care of the sand-based fields.
Yeah, whether educated on the job or educated at school, they needed that,
But we are digressing from our conversation.
Absolutely. Well, so what do you get from your coaches in WestMad? You know, what a...
Well, that's a good question because that's a completely different... Mm-hmm. It's a completely different relationship.
Yeah.
There, you're the teacher, and you're teaching them why we want them to put the tarps on mountain home plate after the games, why we want them to take the bases out after the games, why we can't allow them to practice on this particular day because the groundskeeper at my level at the Little League level now certainly has much more control over the field than you do when you get up to the big daddies, where the marketing department and others have lots of control. Now it's more of a teaching mode, teaching coaches about because you know because most of the coaches that you have at Little League are just fathers that are you know kind of eking through looking
and mothers,
and mothers that are eking through and just know enough to make them dangerous about teaching. So. You know, you do learn, and they learn from watching us more than anything else about what we do to prepare the field and that kind of stuff and the conditions of the field. I remember when I became involved with the Little League in 2002 when my son got involved there. The guy who was taking care of the fields at that time kept saying, "Oh, you'll never get the coaches to do any of that stuff." I said, "Well, did you ever explain to them why they should do it and what benefits it gives to them and their players if they do these kind of things? You hold moisture in the mound and home plate. It's not bone dry. It's not, you know, it doesn't chip out and dig out deeply when you keep the moisture in there. Those kind of, you know, once you explain these things to the coaches, then they understand. And it was amazing to watch how the players and the coaches, because the coaches would involve the players in getting the tarps on, tarps off and stuff, how they began to take ownership of the complex and kept it in good shape. So, you know, if you're dealing with that end of the industry and listening to this podcast, the lesson is, you know, you have to become the teacher as the groundskeeper to teach these people, okay, you know, if you do this, you'll make this field this much better. If you can help me just do these few little things, and I don't want them fixing mounds and home plates. I don't want them doing any of that kind of stuff because they could screw it up. I mean,
yeah.
Basically, they can screw it up.
Yeah.
They're not trained. But the simple things in life, covering those mounds and home plates when they're mm-hmm. not being used, so you're holding that moisture in there, things like that, taking the bases off. You know, I see so many park and recs and places like that where bases will be kept in for days on end, and suddenly their bases are slowly curling up on the corners, and they're wondering why their bases are doing that. Well, it's because the guy's coming in and dragging over the top of the base, or, you know, there's all kinds of reasons. But if you do these most basic of jobs, those little things turn out to be big things in the quality of the field and that kind of stuff. And so that's what the groundskeeper's doing down at that lower levels, is teaching those people mm-hmm. why you should do this and help us out, and it'll help you out in the long haul.
Well, and I'd be curious to hear from some of our soccer or football guys to know what kind of feedback they get at all levels. Because what I understand from the MLS and the university level is that the players have a great respect for the field in soccer, because the grass itself impacts the way that they play their game so much more than we see in baseball. The same way that the infield or the pitcher's mound impacts the way the game is played, the actual grass itself impacts the play of the game in soccer so much more. That they tend to have a great respect for the field, for the groundskeeper, and they also have a lot more knowledge about the turf grass than what you would expect a standard player to have.
And you know, it's kind of funny. One thing that's always bothered me is mm-hmm. that both football and the NFL and the MLS have players that are more deeply involved with monitoring the field situation and putting pressure as a union about how the field should be taken care of versus baseball. And I've never understood why baseball, the union, has mm-hmm. not, the players union, has not taken a more active role in understanding the challenges that groundskeepers have and helping to set rules, mm-hmm. the union helping to set rules of how those fields should be used.
Yeah.
You know, to protect them, because it's their livelihood that they're protecting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's interesting. But you're right, though. MLS guys, they're very concerned with how the ball rolls on the turf, mowing heights, mowing patterns, all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, because it's just like an infielder worrying about ground balls. You know, Cal Ripken never wanted a mowing pattern on his infield. Unfortunately, I was strong-armed by the owner to put one on, but he didn't want those. He didn't want those on there because it affected the grounds, the rolling of the ball on ground balls and stuff. So it's very similar in a soccer situation.
Absolutely.
So. Well, let's check in with our sponsor, and then we'll be back with our guest, Jack Warren. Innovation. That's what we're all about at Beacon. We spend each summer out on fields working with field maintenance equipment, and from that come ideas. Our engineer takes those ideas, develops them, perfects them, and then we test them. Not just once, but daily at our field maintenance research facility. We work out as many bugs as we can while we evaluate the product. Once perfected and the desired performance is achieved, we give it our Beacon-built stamp. That's how we've developed such revolutionary products as the Streamliner Chalker, the Sweet Spot Tamp System, the Phantom Batting Cage, the Beacon Field Weights and Tarp Cart, the Adjustable Weight Nail Drag, and the list goes on and on. We live and breathe sports field management. We walk the walk, and we talk the talk. Don't you think it's time to give Beacon a look? To request a catalog, give us a call at 800-747-5985. Or make a request from our website at www.beaconathletics.com, where our web store is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year long. Okay, it's time for our Out of the Park interview for today, and we're chatting with Jack Warren, owner of Corn Belt Sports and the host of the Top Coach Podcast, a podcast for baseball coaches about coaching baseball. Welcome.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much, Teresa and Paul. I'm excited. I'm a regular listener to your podcast, and so I don't know what I can add, but man, I'm excited to be here.
Well, you can take over if you like, but
I know your tricks here. You're trying to get some stuff off your plate. I'm good.
All right. Well, I tell you what, Jack, why don't you first of all tell our listeners a little bit about your podcast, the Top Coach Podcast?
Yeah, Top Coach Podcast has been around for about going on 3 years now, and we're closing in very rapidly on 200 episodes.
Wow.
And basically, in a nutshell, right, all it is we talk to primarily amateur baseball coaches from across the spectrum. So I'd say it's across the country, but we've actually had coaches from around the world on there, and that's exciting as well. But also at all the levels, we have had summer ball coaches all the way up to Division I coaches and everything in between. We really try to focus on the whole spectrum because of the thousands of coaches who listen and participate in the community. It is a we want to try to reflect what they're doing and where they're at in their journey. And one of the things that makes our discussions unique is that we don't focus on what goes on between the lines. So you're not going to hear what you hear at a clinic, for instance. You're going to hear about career type topics and program level topics, and that's where we keep it. So we'll talk a lot about a coach's journey and a lot about what they do when they're running the program, and we'll leave the other stuff to clinics.
How about your listenership? Do you have any idea of the range that you get for listeners? Is it from, you know, little leagues up to college, or is it more high school, college, or, you know, what would you say is probably your listenership?
You know, if I had to draw a little bell curve or something, I would say that it's primarily the biggest groups are going to be the high school and college coaches. But I hear from coaches all the way. I was just communicating again yesterday with a 10U coach from Kansas. So they're guys who listen because of the things they can pick up. So it is all over the board. And we do have some professional coaches who I communicate with regularly as well. But again, we're focused primarily on the amateurs, but it does go all the way down to little league type ball up through Division I.
Sure. So I would say it'd be fair to say that you have the pulse of the coaching world to a certain degree, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you know what? Between the podcast itself, the feedback I get via text, Twitter, our Facebook page, and the constant traveling I'm doing where I go out to meet coaches at meetups, at games, at conventions, at seminars, and the speaking that I do to teams and organizations, I'm constantly talking to coach. Not a day goes by that I'm not talking to some coach and are talking about what's going on and the things that we can do to help them out.
Oh, cool.
So I'm assuming some of the things that will come up will be about their fields, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a huge concern. It's one of the things we try to talk about as much as we can.
So from your conversations with coaches, and what is their biggest issues with their fields at this point in time?
Well, as you guys are very well aware, I can't think of a high school or collegiate sport or activity where the demands on the coaches are so great from a logistical standpoint. You name the sport, and you don't see any other sport where a coach has to do so much work keeping up their field and facilities.
Yeah.
And so the primary thing for them that I hear constantly is just, what are the tips and tricks that I can do? What are some, you know, how can I cut some corners here and there because of my limited budget? Mm-hmm. As you can imagine, they're worrying about trying to buy baseballs, bats, and uniforms and their travel expenses. And I'm sure you guys have seen the results of this, but sometimes the corners get cut when it comes to their fields. And as teams travel and play in other locations, all of a sudden, I think some of them almost get embarrassed into upgrading their field because they say, well, my mound and my batter's box doesn't look that good.
Yeah.
But it is. It always, always, always comes down to budgetary concerns and what they can do on a very limited budget. And that's it in a nutshell.
Well, and the sad part is if there's budget to be cut, it seems like the administrations always seem to think, well, the easiest first cut to make is the grounds crew or the groundskeeping of a sport field.
Yeah.
And I just don't get that.
Yeah. And the thing is, when I think administration look at it, at the various schools and organizations look at it from a standpoint, when they look at like a golf facility, for instance, our local university has their own golf course. So they're going to look at that a little differently than what they would look at the baseball field or what the high schools in the area look at when it comes to their baseball fields. And that is, they just expect that the coaches are going to take care of it and that they'll have one of their janitors or one of the volunteers mm-hmm. come over and jump on the riding mower and run around real quick and mow it. That's
you could see us, our eyes just rolled over and about fell out of our head from that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is that the golf course is a moneymaker.
Right.
The baseball, in most cases, unless you're in the Deep South, is not.
That is absolutely correct, and that really comes into play. Now, one of the things that we've heard a great deal about, and if you're paying attention right now, take the Big Ten alone, and you guys are right in Big Ten territory, so you understand this. They have been putting more money into the fields in the last 7 years or so than almost any other conference in the United States, because I think with the advent of Big Ten television, they have really understood that these programs, while maybe not generating the revenue of a basketball or football, are mm-hmm. generating some of the interest, and it's bringing them some revenue dollars on television. So you're starting to see some fantastic complexes like the ones at Purdue and Ohio State and Michigan, and unfortunately not Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a long time before Wisconsin sees baseball, I have the feeling.
Yes.
That's a sore subject around this part of the in Cheesehead territory.
Yeah, it should be.
Yeah. You know, what would you say, and you probably don't have a good guess on this, but of the percentage of programs out there, how many of them would you say, what percentage would you say is the, are the coaches required to maintain the field or to help maintain the field? Would you say it's pretty much 100% or?
Well, that varies with level, Paul.
Sure.
Yeah. If you're looking at high school, it's almost 100%.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because even if you had, there's a small school here locally, very tiny high school. And I'm in Central Illinois for those who don't know me. But there's a very small school here where they have a jewel of a field, but it's only been, and you'll know the answer here without me saying it, because of the passion of one man in particular who's taken care of the field and developed it. But what happened was the school assigned one of their janitors to mow the field. And the guy liked mowing the field. He just had no idea how to mow the field. And so he mowed it with enthusiasm, but there became this little, you know, battle going on between the guy who was taking care of upgrading the field and the janitor who was enthusiastic about mowing it. And so you see at high school level, it's almost 100% of coaches that if their field's going to look good, it's going to be because of their effort. Now, when you move up to the junior college and college ranks, more and more of those are being taken care of by some staff that takes care of other fields, that take care of soccer fields and all that. And then, of course, there's the big move on. Anybody who can get turf is trying to get some kind of field turf to put out there. Illinois State University, for instance, about 3 years ago now got their infield field turf, which just changed things dramatically for them. The amount of manpower it requires to prepare their field now is reduced significantly. So it's going to be all over the board, Paul.
Okay, but here's the thing. Here's my argument with that whole thinking. Okay. So they put this field in and they're spending what? Anywhere from, say, $600,000 to $1 million for this artificial turf field.
Yes.
That's probably going to last them 10 to 12 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You break that money down over 10 to 12 years, that's a lot of money you could be putting towards the normal maintenance of the field. That's the part that that drives me crazy. But of course, you're talking about a capital budget versus a operational budget.
Correct.
And as we all know, you know, it's easy to get the capital money sometimes versus getting the operational money to do things.
Yeah, and I think you hit on the key element there, Paul, and that's when they were striving to get that field done, it was easy to go in front of boosters and say, here's the X amount of dollars that we need to get this done, and we can raise this money. That requires a short-term fundraising effort. The other thing that you're talking about, and about potentially having a regular field in there, it requires somebody with a long-term vision. And especially at a state school, that's just not going to happen because you see how transient the whole organization is. Yeah. Take a look 10 years ago at the roster of AD baseball coaches and on, and you're not going to see the same people there. It's really difficult to sustain that effort. So they look at something where they can go in front of the boosters and say, we need $600,000 for this infield turf, and they'll be glad to raise it. And then it takes the pressure off the coach for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I mean, that's actually, you can take that same story all the way down to the Little League level, because that's exactly what happens in a Little League situation in a lot of cases, because the board is such a transient board in a lot of cases. The truly, in my mind, the truly successful Little Leagues are the leagues, and when I say Little Leagues, I mean youth leagues in general, are the leagues that have stable, a pretty stable board where, for instance, our board is made up of about half or less are board members with kids currently in the program. The remaining board members, which is at least 50% and sometimes more, and this is not planned, it just happens this way, are made up of people who are long-term board members whose kids have aged out like mine years ago, but they like the program, they like, you know, everything about it, and they've decided to stay on to help guide the vision. And that's, like you say, that's what you need. You need somebody in there guiding the vision the whole time. And if you have a really transient group that changes continuously, you're right, you're never going to get that long-term goal.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, Paul, because right here, if I was to draw a circle around where I'm at of 25 miles, we're going to have 40 to 50 junior high school, and youth fields around. And I'm not counting the ones that are just that Parks and Rec throws up, you know, that's a dirt infield. We'll have some pretty nice fields around for the high schools and such, and the three colleges that are in town. And consistently, the nicest fields in town are at the Pony Complex that are maintained by a friend of yours, Andy Ammon.
Yep, exactly. Now,
yeah, Andy has driven this whole thing, and they have a board who's bought into his vision. And because of that, they have fields that are absolute gems. Everybody knows what to do, and there's a program from beginning to end. It doesn't start with somebody mowing it twice a week and somebody going out and lining it before the games. The vision is much bigger. It's much broader. It's more stable.
Yeah, it's and he and I have actually, I mean, he's picked my brain quite a bit and taken some of the ideas that we had up at our place and taken them down there. And, you know, he's had his struggles at times, but he's been able to persevere, and he's done a hell of a job down there and become very well known. But that long-term vision, I think, is critical, and you're right. It sounds like the schools have the same issues that you have down at the youth level.
Yeah, you know, Paul, one of the things when I coached for high school and youth ball for about 20 years. And I got to tell you, when I was a coach, I did what I could do, and with no real vision to the future, but it was geared towards that season and what it was going to look at. And yeah. I think that what you're saying is the long-term vision is key to getting some of these things done. And I remember distinctly when it came to what was going, of course, it was the impact on the young people's lives. But on the field, there were two things that brought me the most pride. One was when I saw a pitcher have the confidence to throw a 2-2 changeup over for a strike. That was number one. Number two was a good-looking, well-maintained mound. I was so proud of my mound, but I remember the hours I had to put in to make sure that thing looked good.
Sure. Yeah. You know, coaches can be, for those coaches who have groundskeepers, they can be very integral at teaching those groundskeepers how they want the field. When I went to the major leagues, and it was really Cal Ripken Sr. and Cal Jr. who taught me a lot about how they liked the infield. And then from there, I took it from there and figured out how to achieve what it was they're looking for. But one of the things that was really interesting was watching Cal Sr. teach coaches how to be friends to the groundskeeper, if you understand what I'm saying. As you would see younger coaches come up, they didn't know the right way to do coaching to a certain extent that it caused issues on the field. And he would pull these guys aside and say, no, son, let me show you. This is how you hit fungos. This is how you hit ground balls. You don't chop the ball right into the grass because that puts divots in front of the home plate area and that can affect a ground ball. You want to take you want that first bounce on a ground ball that you're hitting to the infielder during pregame to go way out before it takes the first bounce. He would show them all these things that you would have thought they would have learned a long time ago. But there was a way. And of course, the term around Baltimore was it's the Oriole way. And there was an Oriole way of doing everything, coaching, playing, you name it. And he was the guy who taught all the coaches, this is how you do things on the field. This is where you go. This is where you don't go when you're doing something. You don't go, out in the middle of the infield grass and start hitting fly balls out to the outfielders. You do it on one of the dirt spots. You don't do it out on the grass and things like that. So there's a lot that coaches can learn from groundskeepers about how to do things to help protect their field to keep it nice. But there's also a lot of things that the coaches can relay to the groundskeepers as far as what makes a good field, what is a player looking for specifically. And there's a lot of things that can be done that don't require a lot of money or don't require special tools, things like that.
Yeah, and a good groundskeeper wants to hear that from the coach. They want to give them what
they're
looking
feedback.
For and they've yeah and they will find a way to provide that for them.
Yeah, provided they're not being pounced on all the time and things like that. But
right.
But
yeah.
The point I made in the early part of the interview here, Paul, we talked about how coaching centric this is in baseball, in high school baseball, and how much falls to the coaches. And one of the things that has changed drastically in the last three decades or so is because you and I would remember this, Paul, the old stereotype of the coach in the gray sweats with the whistle around his neck, and he'd been coaching some combination of track, baseball, football, and baseball for 25, 35 years. We don't see that anymore.
No.
And
not at all.
So what you talk about, what you and Teresa are talking about right now, where they would get feedback from the coaches. In tips and instruction, stuff like that just is far less likely to happen because we've got coaches who'll come in for 5 years and are gone. They don't have long-term vision. Coaches just aren't sticking around anymore. When you guys were talking, I was reminded a few years ago, it was Gene Stevenson's last year at Wichita State, and they'd come into town to play a game against Illinois State. And I remember I was there early enough for the batting practice that day. I saw Gene Stevenson standing behind the batting cage. He took a baseball that was laying on the ground, and he took it over the first baseline, and he rolled the ball down the line. Now, it was telling him a couple things. He wanted to see how the ball rolled for a bunt, but it was telling him other things about the field that you wouldn't see a coach who's been coaching 5 years do that. Unless he'd picked it up from a guy like Gene Stevenson, his Obi-Wan or whatever. And that's exactly where we're at right now. Now, the thing that the younger coaches do have as an advantage are resources, online resources, guys like Andy Ahman here locally who they can go to. and podcasts like yours that they can listen to. So there's all kinds of resources now. But, you know, oh, for the day when we had some guys with some long-term vision, though.
Yeah, it's a well, and I can understand it. The coaches are looking for the best deal these days. I mean, that's just the way it is in America anymore. And so you see them moving around, going to the next better place. And to a certain degree, that's a good thing. It keeps new blood coming through, gives new opportunities for new people and things like that. But long-term vision is so critical to any operation that if you don't have that, things are going to fall apart if somebody's not watching the long-term goals.
Absolutely. And that's why coaches talk about building programs, not building teams. And as Brian O'Connor, University of Virginia, and Tim Corbin so aptly put it, it's about culture. It's about building a culture, because all that is a great breeding environment for the things that really count.
Yeah. Where do you think these coaches are getting their education from on field maintenance when they can find it?
You know, I would say, number one, that most guys who are coaching now are going back to what they got at college.
Yeah, when they played.
Good or bad, when they played in college. So good or bad, you know, sometimes that's bad. But quite often it's good. If they even played at a school, a Division III school in the middle of Massachusetts, they're still going to pick up some stuff that they didn't see in high school that usually they will bring back at that point. So believe me, as you guys know, a good groundskeeper and a good head coach gets his team involved in field maintenance. And so that is really where they learn, almost like an internship.
And that, to me, is the most important thing that a coach can do to a player. But the ball players, you would think, would respect that playing field and want that to be perfect. That's their office. That's where they make their profession, and you don't do anything to damage that. So I applaud coaches that get players involved, teach them how to maintain the field, and really get them working on it so that they understand how you do it and why the reason is that it's that particular way that it works.
It's what's fascinating to me is to watch very successful programs, whether it's a Division I program like a Vanderbilt or a Florida, or whether it is a successful local high school program. When they talk about culture, it's not only talking about the culture of winning, the culture of doing things right. It filters down to the little things like who's picking up in the dugout after the game.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Andy Ammon taught me early on when I first met Andy, he was showing me how it's easy to convince a third baseman to rake or sweep the dirt off the grass right in front of him, because if he got a bad hop that game. And so everybody takes care of their portion of the field and everybody gets better hops.
Or not to stand right on that turf edge and wear that out. Another place that you could suffer from a errant ground ball hitting that area there. You know,
absolutely.
Those kind of things. And, you know, we start that at our little league complex. We start that right off the bat. When I first got involved there, you know, I would say things like, why aren't you having the coaches put the tarps on at the end of the night, taking the bases out, things like that. Oh, we'll never get the coaches to do that. Well, I said, well, have you ever explained to them why it's important? These coaches want better fields, but if you explain to them, you know, they have to put in their 2 cents worth to make it work, we can have a better complex. And now, you know, it's common knowledge in our group, and the kids learn from the very first time when they get on our fields at 7 years old till the time they're done and move on at 16, they're putting the tarps on at the end of the games. You know, they do everything because they understand that it helps maintain the integrity of the playing surface.
You are dead on. And again, that comes down to a whole thing about breeding the right culture, and long-term successful programs are only long-term and successful because they breed this kind of culture. And that's the culture of doing the little things right. I'm always reminded of the story told about John Wooden, where he talked about the first thing he did when he brought new players into UCLA, he showed them how to put their socks and their shoes on properly. A little detail that you wouldn't think would be that important. But it's the same thing that successful baseball coaches do when they start addressing things, not only about how to go to first, third on a single, but how it is they take care of the field, because that's important to their success.
Well, coaches and groundskeepers have a high stake in the game to make sure that the field stays playable and it allows the players to perform at their highest level, provided that the field is maintained properly as well. And I think the more communication that goes on between coaches and groundskeepers, I think the better off it's going to be for the game as a whole. Like you say, you set these people up for life for those who stay in the game to understand why things are done that way, to maintain the integrity of the playing surface, to allow those players then to have a great playing surface to play on. So I think you and I got a lot of work ahead of us.
Absolutely. But I think we're on the right track.
Well, Jack, it's been great having you here today. We appreciate your time. For those of you who get a chance, tune into the Top Coach podcast and take a listen to what they're all about. Jack, they can find you where?
TopCoachPodcast.com or TopCoachBaseball.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at TopCoachPodcast.
Now, is your podcast available on iTunes as well?
iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Google Play now. It's on almost anywhere. You can go to the website and listen to it as well from the website.
Very good. Thank you very much, Jack, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
You bet. You guys keep up your good work.
Rain. For a sports turf manager, it can be a godsend as it provides the needed water crucial to the life of your turf grass. But during baseball and softball seasons, it can be the thorn in your side on game days. Let Beacon relieve the pain of rainy game days with a full line of wet weather management tools to keep you in the game. Cover it up with Beacon's Field Shield 8-ounce tarps, available in all sizes from full infield to small area tarps. Anchor it down with Beacon's field weights and do away with those bulky, messy sandbags. Or use our new Pro Tarp Pins, so bright you won't lose these in your turf. Haul it off by using the Beacon Tarp Cart for moving and storing your mound and plate tarps off the field. Water on the field? Suck it up using Beacon's reusable puddle sponges, puddle pumps, or Diamond Pro Calcine Clay drying agents to get your games up and running again. Take the pain out of the rain and let Beacon help you. Call Beacon at 800-747-5985 to talk to our experienced staff, or check us out on the web at www.beaconathletics.com, where we're open 24/7 and ready to take your order. And we're back.
Hooray.
And we're going to talk about fungi.
Still my favorite joke. Mushroom walks into a bar, says, "Can I have a beer?" Bartender says, "Nope, we don't serve mushrooms." Points to a sign, says, "No mushroom." He goes, "What? I'm a fungi." Oh, Dr. Houston Couch, I miss you so much. Oh, my goodness. No, we should talk about disease, Paul.
Yeah, it's going to be that time of the year, certainly, as we get into the summer months. And listening to what some of the forecasts are for the summer for the eastern half of the country, at least, with a lot of heat expected. I know I was reading that parts of the East Coast up in the Mid-Atlantic area could see 1.5 times the amount of days above 90 that what they normally see there. So that doesn't bode well and you wonder why I moved back to Wisconsin.
Oh, I love it up here. I'm never moving back down south.
Absolutely. But, so they're looking at a lot of heat, and also, long-term forecasts are calling for quite a bit of drought in the eastern half of the country.
Well, and normally that's good news for disease.
Yes, it is. But for us turf grass managers, it means, oh, crap, we got to water more.
Exactly.
And that's where the problem ensues.
I think so. Yeah. And, another disclaimer, just like before when we were talking about weeds. I don't have a degree in turf grass pathology, folks. So if I get something wrong, please let me know and we'll make a correction. But it is something that we should all be thinking about, whether we have a pathology degree or not. So I wanted to hit on a couple that are some pretty big ones. Right now, dollar spot. Did you ever get any problems with that on your field?
Never had it ever on any of my ball fields.
A lot of...
whether it was either one of my major league fields or my minor or my little league fields, where I learned to loathe dollar spot was on the golf course when I was in turf school for the 3 years I was working in golf, because that you'd saw it all the time then.
Yeah. I would see it in the minors, on the Kentucky bluegrass in the minors, because you're trying to keep it up at a higher level. But you know, you're still... your hands are tied in a lot of ways, so you're not able to do preventative maintenance as far as the disease is concerned, and so you'd see it and then you'd get on top of it as quick as possible. So.
And that's exactly why I never saw it in the majors, is because you've got a budget for chemicals, and you were treating it to the hilt to keep the worst of the stuff, mm-hmm. and by covering that, you were covering all the other stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So especially something like dollar spot. That's the good news, is this one's easy to kill. Any chlorothalonil product will knock it down, and then just talk with your extension agent or a trusted salesman for extended control on that. But the reason I bring it up is because now is the season. Tis the dollar spot season, my friends. If you've got extended leaf wetness, which a lot of folks have, we've been a little bit wet this spring. And when daytime temperatures get between 50 and 80 degrees, so dollar spot season, y'all. I'm the whitest person you know. your main grasses for this are Kentucky bluegrass and ryegrass. And so if you do get it,
right. So,
like we said, you're not as likely to see this on low maintenance fields. But if you've been trying some new things out, maybe doing a little extra fertilization, you might see it. So if you do have it, you want to practice what I call safe mowing, where the field with the dollar spot should be mowed last, and the mower should be well cleaned afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you say well cleaned, explain that a little bit more for the listeners.
Well, you really want to get in there, spray it down completely, get all of your excess leaves off of there. If you've got some soap and you can get out and soap it up, and that includes the blades especially, soap it up, rinse it off, get it really clean before you get out and use it on a different field.
So we're not talking about an acid bath or a bleach bath or anything like that. You're just talking about soap and water.
That's all I've ever been told to do. I don't know. Were you ever told to do any bleach on there?
No, I wasn't.
Yeah.
But again, I never dealt with it because we were always chemically treating it. And of course, I've only ever had one disease problem on the Little League fields for the most part.
Oh.
We'll get into that a little bit later.
Well, the other disease that I think might be a big one this year is going to be summer patch. And this one.
Absolutely.
Such a pain in the butt, because by the time you know you got it, it's too late.
Right.
Nothing you can do.
And I can speak to summer patch, because that's all I worried about in Baltimore was summer patch. And the other problem is once you have summer patch, you've got it. It's in the soil.
You got it.
It's going to stay there. Yep. We had that nonstop both at the old ballpark and at the new ballpark. And by charting it the first couple of years at Oriole Park, it was interesting because you could tell where it was going to show up first all the time. By doing daily observations of where it would show up first and logging it on a map, we come to discover that it was always left center field, right back by the warning track, is typically the first spot, you know, almost in the power alley, basically, at Oriole Park, is typically where you'll see summer patch show up first. And then No, not at all.
No.
It's right in the sun. It's right in the heat of the action. And maybe that's why. Because why do you see the stress? Because there's no roots there from a water intake.
That's what I was trying to figure out, was why you didn't have why your roots weren't as good there. Yeah.
Yeah. But, the reason, and I agree with Teresa, I think it's going to be a bad year, because we've had a cool and wet spring in a lot of places all over the country.
Yeah.
And typically that's very classic setup for yes. getting into, and once you get into the hot summer, the summer patch hits. The problem is with summer patch, if you want to catch it and really keep it down, you've got to start spraying for it. Typically, if I recall, once your soil temperatures get 50 degrees 3 days in a row is wow. when you have to start spraying in the spring.
You've got more info on that spraying. Than I do.
Well, and that's what I recall from when I was, this is back in the 90s, mm-hmm. When we were spraying for it all the time.
Ah.
Now, things may have changed a little bit since then, but that's typically what triggered us. And the funny thing was, when we moved from Memorial Stadium to Oriole Park, that date moved way up earlier because, of course, the sandy-based soils warm up a lot faster yep. than the native soils.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of things like that you got to think about.
Yes.
And that's why we monitored our soil temperatures every day. We took readings 4 times a day and logged those things.
Hmm.
And that's what allowed us to know, okay, hey, it's time to start spraying.
Yeah.
And that's just good practice for any groundskeeper, you know, keeping those soil temperatures and logging what you see happening on the field all the time. You know, they call that
IPM.
IPM, yes.
Integrated
I never
pest
thought
management.
Of it that way, but of course, that's what they always called it. But mm-hmm. that's what I was doing, was looking for trends and that kind of stuff to see when things would show up. So yeah, and with that cool spring and the wet spring we're having, and then the promise of a hot summer and drought. You can bet your bottom dollar there's going to be a lot of people, especially in the transition zone, that are going to be dealing with summer patches summer. And that's been moving north as the decades have been going on because of the change in climate a little bit.
Yep. Yep. I'm expecting we'll see some of that up here in our neck of the woods up here in Minnesota if it gets hot enough. The biggest risk is where you have extra nitrogen, not enough potassium. One yep. of the things I've been learning lately is the balance between nitrogen and potassium is so key to keeping our grasses growing well. And I learned that from the agriculture side of things. And I've been amazed at how much of a difference that has made when looking at clients' fields, keeping the N and the K balanced, the nitrogen and the potassium balanced. Anytime we go out with N, we go out with a matching amount of potassium, if not a little yep. bit more.
And that was a... Oh, that's yep. especially true on a sand-based field.
Absolutely.
More yeah. still than a native soil field. But and I learned that very quickly, again, at Oriole Park, that when we put down a pound N, we also put down a pound of P, or K, rather.
Yep.
You have to.
Yep. You're going to see this more in when we've got drought stress. Again, so that'll be more likely to happen in sandy soils than in clayey soils. But... you may see it in clay soils if you have some poorly drained areas. Basically, anywhere mm-hmm. where your roots are very weak is where you're more likely to see this. That's where your grass is more likely to become infected in the spring, and it's where you're more likely to see the damage in the summer. And so the you can't treat it once you have it, unfortunately. You can't treat it curatively. The best you can do is just try to support the grass that you do have and keep it as healthy as possible.
Right.
You will have to treat it preventatively in the spring, and that's really the only option for that. And
it's a costly disease to prevent. Mm-hmm. But there are some excellent chemicals out there
yep.
still to this day, and yep. it is effective. But again, once you get it in the soil, once you get summer patch in the soil, it's there for good, and you almost have to become accustomed to preventively spraying or accepting the fact that you're going to get it every year.
I mean, the good news is that you're less likely to see this on a low maintenance field because it is low maintenance
yeah.
because you don't have the extra nitrogen.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it is something just to kind of keep in mind. If you're starting to ramp things up, if you have been instituting some new programs and you're treating your grass a little bit more like a medium maintenance field, that's the time that you want to start watching out for this because you're still learning about balancing your nutrients. You're still learning about getting the nitrogen applied properly in the spring and not over applying it.
The things we do at the professional level to push our turf with the aggressive fertilization programs, those are what cause
most of these
issues.
Yes.
And that's why at the lower levels, like at my little league complex or high school, you don't see these diseases a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you're pushing the plant to do things it doesn't want to do, especially in the summertime. If you're putting nitrogen on in the summertime, you can, you know, bet the farm that you're going to be dealing with some diseases at some point in time.
Yeah.
If you're being aggressive with your watering and your fertilization.
Yeah. I mean, and that's cool season grasses. Like you and I were talking about, yeah. Most warm season grasses, they might get a disease in the summertime, but a turf manager who's well-trained, be it from school or from experience, is not going to have this issue. You are going to be fertilizing more in the summer, and you want to be, and that's what's going to help you stay away from these diseases. Actually, I think Dr. Couch used to tell us that you would get these diseases, not necessarily these, but the diseases on warm season grasses, but the grass was so healthy and growing so well, it just grew right out of it, and you never even knew it was there.
Well, that's right. It's such, you know, southern grasses, for the most part, are such aggressive grasses that whatever damage you get grows out pretty quick.
Yeah.
And I always used to say that, you know, I think it's easier for a southern turf groundskeeper. It's easier for a northern turf groundskeeper to move south and deal with southern grasses than it is for southern grass groundskeeper to move north and deal with all the diseases that we have to deal with. That's the way I feel about it, because
it depends on,
you can't kill Bermuda grass.
It depends on their transition. If they have to transition and keep it green throughout the winter with ryegrass, that's tricky.
Oh, yeah.
That is an art, my friend. There is very little science behind that. That is art all the way.
I think the bigger art, in my opinion, only because I've only done it a few times and I hated it, was the transitioning process of changing it over from the rye overseed to the just straight out Bermuda.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, going into and out of dormancy can be a bear. Yeah, absolutely. Back to diseases, though. I just want to wrap this up really quick. A couple of things to look out for on the low maintenance side would be brown patch. It's not going to be devastating. It's more likely to happen when you have poor drainage. So this is, I think, where we see irrigation causing a problem because of the way that we irrigate versus the way that Mother Nature provides rain. You're more likely to see where drainage problems will be exacerbated. And that's where brown patch is more likely to occur. It'll happen on perennial ryegrass, tall fescue, Kentucky bluegrass. Like I said, you probably don't have to treat it as much as you would have to back off your watering and give the grass a chance to dry its feet out a little bit. But you can treat it, and it's pretty easy to treat if you do get it. And like I said, I think it's more likely to occur on a low maintenance turf. Now, if you're not putting any nitrogen down, you probably won't see it. But if you have even a little bit of nitrogen that goes down, even in this, you know, even if it's mostly in the fall versus any applied in the spring, you may see some brown patch. And so you do want to just kind of keep an eye out for that while we're going through a droughty period and you're watering. The other thing to look for is gray leaf spot. I mentioned this not because it's likely, but because it is still kind of a hot disease. We've got more of a bead on it. We can treat it a little bit more effectively than we could when it first started really coming out and becoming a problem, where it was taking out entire swaths of fairways. Gosh, that was an interesting summer when that happened. I felt so sorry for the guys who got
it. That was in the 90s. I'll never forget that. I was still in Baltimore, and gray leaf spot, which affects ryegrass. Was taking out entire golf courses in the Mid-Atlantic region while I was in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And there were golf courses that would overseed that course, you know, two, three times in the fall trying to get something back. But of course, it would just keep reinfecting itself.
Yeah.
And many golf course superintendents lost their jobs.
Yes.
That year.
And it wasn't their fault at all.
And it wasn't their fault at all. But it was a nasty disease that just would take stuff damn near overnight. Very similar to Pythium in the days when Pythium was big.
Yep.
So.
And both of those are hot weather diseases. You know, you're going to see them more when they're hot and humid. So you're more likely to see it where you're irrigating. And you're also more likely to see them where you are applying nitrogen during the summertime. So if you are a low maintenance facility and you're thinking about trying the nitrogen, maybe talk to somebody first before you put it out there. I know it can help you with wear a little bit, but depending on what your weather profile is looking like these days, it might be better off, you know, succumbing to the wear so that you don't succumb to disease.
Right. Yeah. My advice typically to people who are up in the northern climates in the cool season grass areas is stay away from nitrogen as much as possible in June and July. You can start applying it again in August. And by that time, typically you're starting to get pretty safe. Mm-hmm. Now I say that, and last year for the first time ever, I got nailed with Pythium at our Little League complex as we were bringing up new seedlings in August. Yeah, because that's the time that we have that's the only time during the year we have to renovate.
Yeah, so I have no choice. You don't have a choice. And it was warm here in August last year.
And we got about a Pythium on a couple of our fields that my guys didn't spot in time until they had already done some mowing and stuff. And they
tracked it.
You can track that stuff all over the place. Because if they were out mowing early in the morning, the mycelium there are nice and active. Boy, whoop, you just spread it out throughout the whole field. And we took some pretty serious damage from that. But Pythium you don't see a lot of now because people have gotten really good at it. But I remember back in the 80s when I got started in baseball and in golf.
That was a really big one.
Back then.
Yeah. We do have a good bead on it, which is kind of nice. So
sounds like we've got a lot of good beads going.
Yeah, that's true. I really need to find a new expression.
Well, that was fun with fungi, but we're going to have to close the book on this episode.
Hey. Well, don't miss a minute of our next show, folks. There are lots of places to find us. You can come to our webpage at beaconathletics.com/podcast. Actually, this week I will have some links for you. It's all about diseases. I found a couple of excellent resources that I think you'll enjoy reading through. You can download our show, of course, through Apple iTunes, which is probably what you did. But you can find us also through baseballtalkradio.com or baseballpodcast.net.
We'd love to hear from you, especially if you loved all this talk about fungi. Just had to see that one.
Yep.
You can email Teresa and me at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your questions or comments on the show, good or bad. If you have show ideas, send them along as well. I've got one I'd like to talk to about toe fungus next week.
Ew.
If that's possible. No? Okay.
And if by chance you're on Twitter, you can follow us at Diamond Da Vinci's. That's at Diamond DAVINCIS. Not crazy active there, but we do have things we share once in a while.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 68 years, providing solutions for sports turf managers. And from that, I say sayonara.
Adios.